Continuing the 15 and 60 from yesterday, we did Washington through the Minnesota Timberwolves yesterday, so you can go back and look, listen to that. If you haven't yet, we're going to finish up with Memphis through Dallas today in the Western Conference. Sponsors today, Movement Watches, mvmtwatches.com/capspace is the URL to get 15% off your order with them. And then Distilled Premium Denim. distilleddstld.com/capspace gets you $10 off your first order with them. Danny, let's start with the now 8-5 Memphis Grizzlies.
8-5, 5-1 since the last time we recorded this, 24th on offense and tied for 6th for defense. And the biggest thing for me since the last time we recorded this was the game that they played on Saturday against the Timberwolves, when they played really well overall defensively, but the standout was Tony Allen. Andrew Wiggins was 2 of 11 from the field in that game. He's had a very good season overall. Allen looked absolutely great out there.
Yeah, that's huge for them to get just one more good rotation player. They had been getting some decent minutes out of Andrew Harrison, but not a guy who should be starting, maybe more of a 10-15 minute a game guy, even at the nice level that he's played at so far this season. On offense, you noted they're 24th. That is skewed negatively by a few of these games where they've had the JV squad, as you like to call them, without Gasol and without Conley, and obviously it's going to be a massive struggle for them. Offensively, this is a team still that posts up a ton, I think maybe even more than they did last year. Gasol and Randolph both in the top 5 in number of post-up possessions so far. Overall, the Grizzlies post up on 11.9% of their possessions, but opponents only post up 6% of the time, which is a bottom 5 rate. So they really are going to the post a lot more. And that would indicate not even necessarily that they're so good at post defense, but just that opponents seem to be trying a little bit more to go with players who are not post players, spread them out a bit. And you know, Randolph and Gasol are really kind of too big to try and post up anyway. Randolph really has been fantastic off the bench. I think pretty clear to me that so far, at least, that has worked for Coach David Fizdale.
It has. And who would have thought that staggering them actually opens up more post up opportunities because you're not playing them together?
Well, there are two. I was of two minds about that. One was, back in the day, Randolph was such a beast that opponents would have to put their center on him, and then Gasol would always have the mismatch against the power forward. You could just say, all right, one of these guys is always going to have a mismatch when they're both on the floor. But especially considering that they don't have a ton of shooting on this team, with Parsons having been out for most of the year, and as we mentioned yesterday, he's going to miss another 2 weeks with a bone bruise in his opposite knee from the one that he had surgery on. I think that it's not even necessarily in terms of them having space, which helps, but it's more just that they can be the focus when they're out there, right? Like Randolph, 31% usage. That's actually the second highest of his career so far, 7% higher than last year. And that's even when you consider where they were last year. The last 20, 25 games after Conley and Gasol went down, he was the only offensive force that they had. And now teams were maybe able to double him. They didn't have a ton of shooting. That could be part of that. But he really has just been much better. He also rebounding at a much higher rate. He was 20% rebound rate overall last year. Now 32.8%. His offensive rebounds are up a couple of percentage points. So I think the fact is that he has way more energy. He's able to work hard for those deep post-ups, playing less minutes, and his true shooting percentage a little bit below the league average. But when you consider he's coming off the bench, he's not going to be someone who's taking away possessions from some of your best players when he's in that role. That's totally fine for scoring off the bench. He gives them somewhere to go. So while maybe this bench centerpiece thing for these post players has not worked in some instances, I think it's really working well, and they're making just a huge effort to get him the ball, in part because they just don't really have anybody else who can create offense off the bench.
They have done the best job of executing that concept of anybody else, and also Randolph fits the bill to a T of somebody who can benefit from playing fewer minutes more intensely. It's a lot easier to say for a guy who's kind of a little bit older with pride than for a player who's like, let's say, Jahlil Okafor, who sees it as a demotion, you know, somebody like that, or what would happen to Nick Vucevic if the Magic ever did that to him. And so Randolph has embraced it. They have the right kind of surrounding talent to make it work. And something else that's been notable, though it also does relate to Tony Allen not playing as much due to injury, they're 12th in three-point attempts this year.
Yeah, 12th in three-point attempt rate. And right, in the last healthy season, 2014-15, because last year the numbers were all jacked up with everybody missing so much time, they were 29th in three-point attempt rate. Now, part of that, I think, is the fact that they're playing with more spacing at the four than they did in that year. So that's another part of how this Randolph to the bench unit has worked. Is you get more guys who can shoot the ball, even if it's a Jamichael Green or Jarrell Martin type of guy. Although they have, even on the second unit now, been going with two bigs more, with Davis and Randolph as one of the preferred combinations of late. Also noteworthy that Tony Allen hasn't played at all, really, other than these last two games when the defense has been unbelievable with him in there. So that's clearly going to go down once he starts playing more. But if they're going to be back at this top five level of defense, then this team is going to be really good. And I've worried a little bit about Marc Gasol not looking as good defensively as he has in past years. And he has been getting beat a lot at the rim. Like when he goes against Karl Towns, usually he's been lit up, as opposed to, except for this last game. When he goes against some of these quicker players, like Giannis was able to go right around him quite a bit. Although Giannis, seeing him in person yesterday at the Bucks shoot around and then at the game, I mean, that guy is like pretty damn close to 7 feet tall. Like his steps are just, I mean, he might be taller and stronger and probably more athletic than like Kevin Durant is at this point in his career. Wow. But that's a quick aside. But I like what I'm seeing from these guys, and they've had some luck in close games, had some kind of legendary wins. All Gasol, that overtime game where he hit a bunch of threes against New Orleans. There was the tip-in. There was that corner three where he did the legendary dance afterwards. But now they've had two blowout wins in a row too. And I think if you take out those JV games, they're looking pretty good, especially with their main guys on the floor. So as long as Conley and Gasol, I mean, even without Parsons, I think they can stick around at least 500 and play playoff level of basketball, as long as those guys aren't going to go down. And both of them have been very healthy so far to start the year.
Knock on wood, definitely need to do that. But yeah, there's a lot of encouraging signs. It is, I guess you could call it funny that they're still playing really slowly. They're 28th in pace. But the more important part than with speed is that they've played well with their best players out there, and they haven't had, it's not this like unfairly biased sample, because Tony Allen missed a bunch of time, Chandler Parsons missed a bunch of time, and the JV squad. So I think that I feel more encouraged about where they are right now than I did before the season started.
Vince Carter, of course, continues to play very well. We've talked about him on some of the previous programs, but 36.7% on three-pointers, taking 55% of his shots from down there. He's also defended pretty well. And with he and Allen, I think they can at least get by on the wings through this latest Parsons absence. And then Mike Conley has also been ridiculous on isolations, only 24 of those possessions, but 1.29 points per possession. That's going to come down again, of course, but it shows that he has been effective to date. What do you think their record's going to be at the end of the season? And we'll make the assumption that, other than maintenance, Gasol and Conley stay relatively healthy all year, maybe Parsons is like kind of spotty. Where do you see them ended up now?
Around 500, maybe a little bit over. I'll say 42-40.
I think they might do a little bit better than that. If you're going to tell me that Gasol and Conley are both going to play over 70 games, I like them in the more like the 45-46 win range, especially just with what they're able to do in close games. Like, I'm going to start giving them a little credit for that. 538 projects them at only 41-41, as you noted. Again, I think that's pricing in some of those bad JV squad losses. I think as long as those two main guys can stay healthy, they're going to be decent.
Ready to move on to the Lakers?
Indeed. 7-7, 3-4 since we last checked in on them. They're playing against the Bulls right now as we record this.
That loss is actually counted in these stats.
Oh, they lost to the Bulls?
They lost to the Bulls.
Ah, well, good for the Bulls. bad for the Lakers. The Lakers, yes. 8th in offense when I did these yesterday, 24th on defense. And we predicted, I think, that their defense would kind of continue to regress. How many points did they give up to the Bulls today?
118.
That's bad.
Yeah. They had 30, they had 30 points in the first, 30, 32, 28, 28. Not exactly gangbusters, considering Chicago was playing without Dwayne Wade in this game.
Yeah, they don't have McDermott. They started Mirotić at the three in that one, too. It was, I think it's going to be hard for these guys to defend, and maybe they're going to need to get more out of Deng to defend better and play Mozgov a little bit more, that maybe some of the magic that they had early with this switching stuff down the stretch, that just overall they have not really defended well. This, although Mozgov may not be the answer, because their starters are just getting lit up on defense. All those guys, even before the Bulls game, had 109 plus defensive ratings. Of course, like, that's pretty much close to the worst in the league level. The bench actually has defended much better. They all have 102 defensive ratings or below. And I've liked what I've seen from Ingram defensively. Walton has said that he really believes that he's a good defensive player right now. He's provided a little bit more in terms of kind of shot blocking and athleticism than I thought he would provide at this point on defense. You don't see guys just like going straight through him the way, you know, maybe like a Patrick McCaw for Golden State does. Like, Ingram is able to use enough of his length where, you know, he can provide resistance to some of those guys who have a little bit more power so far. And also, they haven't been putting him so much in those type of matchups. They haven't faced those type of teams a ton. I mean, how are you feeling about them now? They were 7-5, huge feel good story, couple of ugly losses here in a row. Is this reversion to the mean that we all knew was coming, or can they snap out of it?
It's mostly reversion to the mean. I mean, their defense was outperforming expectations. And one of my favorite ridiculous stats, I sometimes get on these kicks going through the NBA media stats site, and you can sort out like the best trios, and you can do a lot of different things. And so it's of the 250 most used three-person combinations, the best non-Clippers three-player combination in the entire NBA in net rating: Brandon Ingram, Larry Nance Jr., Lou Williams, plus 21.9 before tonight's game.
Yeah, I don't know that that'll necessarily continue, and the bench has definitely been good. And maybe, I mean, who knows? Maybe they like start Ingram soon over Deng. Like, but gosh, I mean, to say that they can't, because like Deng and Mozgov were supposed to improve the defense, and they just haven't done that. Part of that, too, I think, is, you know, they've got D'Angelo Russell out there. Nick Young has been better on defense. He's been providing a lot on offense as well. He's shooting 63% on twos right now, 70% on twos outside of 16 feet. But the good news, though, is that he's actually like shooting a ton of his shots as three-pointers, and that's a way for him to maintain efficiency. You know, he's not going to stay 65% true shooting, but it's not impossible that he's above the league average. He was under D'Antoni actually in that 2013-14 season. And so if his D continues to be decent, that's a valuable player. I think in a real system, maybe he actually can provide, you know, close to efficient play. And he's also been essential to them playing small effectively as one more body at the two and the three. I mean, so even if he's going to be effective, they are a feel-good story. I think the offense can continue to be pretty good. But there is another reason for regression, too, and that is that they are scoring 1.13 points per possession as a team on isolations. Second place right now is Cleveland with one. And as we know, really, the league average is about 0.8. And they don't have, like, some unbelievable ISO scores. I know that Randall is decent in that at times, but, you know, he's not like Kevin Durant or LeBron James or one of these guys. Like, that number is really going to come down a lot. Also, I think their shooting is going to come down, and I think, you know, we talked about they're going to end up maybe 15th on offense, 22nd to 25th on defense the last time we talked about them in the pod about whether they're going to continue. And I think the results, at least these next two games, only two games, has made me continue to think in that vein.
I want to read through their upcoming schedule probably between now and the next 15 and 60 that we do on them, just because it will be, let's call it, clarifying for this Lakers team. Host Oklahoma City, at the Warriors, host the Warriors, host the Hawks, at the Pelicans, at the Bulls, and then I believe they go at the Raptors, and then at Memphis on a back-to-back. So if they can, if they go more than 2-8, so if they go like 2-6, I would even be impressed.
Let's get to the Clippers now. 12-2, 7-1 since we last checked in on them. The lone loss, that classic against Memphis last week. They are second in offense and second in defense. And even since I think we did that pod on the surprise teams, their defense is like regressed by about 6 points per 100. They have had three games in a row now where two of which they've won against the Kings and the Bulls, but they haven't looked like quite as dominant. And this is kind of they're going back to kind of where I think they'll be. I mean, I don't think they're going to be like a plus 13 net rating team all year. I think they're going to be like +8, +9. I think they'll be kind of around your standard 60 win team, and that's the direction they seem to be trending in.
They're very, very good. They just aren't as insanely great as they were at the beginning of this season. And something, I mentioned this on yesterday's show, but then now since Clippers fans are hopefully listening to this, I did a full Real Jam Radio podcast with Dan Wojcicki of the Orange County Register. One of the big differences that they've had over the last little bit, and it's changing now, is that they had to move from Wes Johnson on the second unit to Brandon Bass. And what that did was it changed them from being more of a switch happy 1-4 system to a little bit more regimented, because they were using Bass and using Paul Pierce in that role. And it took away some of their edge defensively, but they were also just playing way over their heads there. And the bench has come back to earth a little bit, which isn't the whole reason that they've, you know, downgraded a little bit, but it's a part of it.
Yeah, it is. That's something we talked a little about on the 15, or I'm sorry, not the 1560, the Twitter NBA show as well. But they still have had some great, great results, some of which may regress. I'm going to read off some of them. Chris Paul, among the top couple players in the league, 1.37 points per isolation possession. He's had 30 of those so far during the season. That, of course, is not something that's going to sustain, but he is excellent at, I mean, at getting to his spots and pulling up for his mid-ranger. That's what most of those are. DeAndre Jordan, he is, as the time I checked this, which was before the Bulls game last night, he had played 12 games and he had 13 post-ups. I'm willing to guess that 12 of those 13 post-ups were the very first play of the game, when they run a post-up for him every time and then never go back to it. He, of course, is scoring a mere 0.54 points per possession on those post-ups.
And he's one of the most efficient players in the league otherwise, because he's so good at everything else that he does in his kind of in his repertoire as a pick and roll finisher, as a dunker, you know, just in all those spots. Though he is notably only shooting 61% at the rim this year, which is lower than you would expect and lower than his track record.
Yeah, I mean, he's usually shooting like 80%, 70. I mean, he's shooting 61% at the rim. I mean, that's pretty much all of his field goal attempts. And he started a little bit more slowly last year as well in terms of his shooting right at the rim. Ended up being what he normally was. At some point, though, that otherworldly athleticism is going to just be like a little bit more worldly. And he'll still be a solid threat off the pick and roll and for alley-oops, but he just won't be like so ridiculous. And at 27, that's something that can happen. He has, of course, probably having the best defensive season of his career so far, as his athleticism hasn't waned that much and his intelligence and communication has only continued to improve. Another thing is Blake Griffin, only 1 point per possession as the role man. He used to be one of the best role men in basketball, who would just dunk on your head on the pick and roll. That's not really what he does anymore. Now he's either looking to catch the ball and dribble to the free throw line and throw a pass, or he's just going to take his spot up. And 1 point per possession, that is well below the league average as a role man on those 43 possessions. So that just shows, again, how he's being used. It's much more pick and pop than it is him going hard to the rim the way he did, you know, when he was much younger. And I think that's kind of how he has to play for them to get enough spacing on the floor. But it does provide some reason why you'd want to say maybe he should play some with Most Bates, so that he can actually get some of those roles to the rim.
And part of the reason that would work is that Most Bates has been phenomenal on spot up so far this year, beyond dominating the Bates threes versus Whiteside assists, 16-10 right now. He's 1.27 points per possession on spot ups.
And that was actually before yesterday's game against the Bulls, when he was ridiculous.
Yesterday he had 16 points. He was huge. I enjoyed him playing at the end of the fourth quarter over DeAndre, because they wanted his floor spacing out there and they didn't really need DeAndre's defense on that, let's call it, ineffective Chicago offense.
Yeah, well, and it was really useful because they couldn't play Robin Lopez, who's been really good, because he just couldn't guard Bates. And they went with Bobby Portis, but he was too slow to deal with them too. I mean, the Bulls just really had no answer for Bates. And when he's shooting like that, he can be great. He's a guy that you can get a lot out of, and maybe someone whose statistics will maybe overrate the type of player that he is, because he's one of these guys that when he has a good matchup or when he really has it rolling, he gets left in the game. Otherwise, he misses a couple shots and you just take him out. One other thing too, we got to talk about JJ Redick. I noted he was struggling a little bit. That was very early on. He's been absolutely on fire. I mean, he had a couple of games with like 7 threes and a half. He had 7 threes in the second half of that Memphis game. He was ridiculous in the first half of the Sacramento game. And now he's actually age 32, 18 PER, 65% true shooting, and most impressive to me, 22.6% usage for a guy who's a shooting specialist. You want to compare him to a guy like Kyle Korver, who's like, you know, 15% or something, that Redick is able to just get that many shots up in addition to the incredible efficiency that he's had so far, and you consider the age that he's at, really remarkable what he's been able to do. I mean, he may not continue at quite this pace, but to have the highest usage of his career with all the other threats that they have and the highest efficiency, just ridiculous.
The usage is particularly impressive because he plays such a high percentage of his minutes with those other starters, with Blake, with DeAndre, with Chris. And yeah, a couple of those guys, especially when Luke Richard and Bamute is on the floor, are lower usage in a lot of the traditional senses. Like, they don't just dominate the ball. As you said, it's very different from what Korver's doing. And while I don't think this is the biggest thing in his mind, this is a contract year for JJ Redick. And assuming that the Clippers kind of keep it together, he's going to have the leverage to get some real money out of them now.
We will move on to the Houston Rockets momentarily, but first a word from Distilled. Distilled at dsdld.com/capspace, the URL to get started with them. Well, I've been on this trip. I've kind of ashamed to admit that I was a little bit too lazy to bring my suits with me, only going to two games. But I did bring my Distilled jeans, which I feel like are awesome as well. Been wearing pairs of those every day. And the awesome thing about Distilled is that this is the sort of timeless luxury grade denim that's going to cost you hundreds of dollars if you're in a department store. I've never been one of these $300 jeans guys, although I was always secretly jealous of the people who decided that they could afford to spend that much. Now I'm no longer jealous of them because I'm getting those type of jeans for a mere $65 and up to really only into the very low 100s. The way that they do it is by eliminating excessive markups. They don't work with middlemen. It's only available on the website. And they ship directly to you for free, and they guarantee you the fit. If it doesn't work, they'll send you a new pair. Actually, I messed up and ordered my first pair a little bit too small. I was a little optimistic. This was before I began the challenge with Danny, but they were kind enough to send me a new pair. It's very, very easy to deal with their customer service. They also have a new line of fall jackets as well, with either classic denim or a stylish bomber jacket, and you can get that same level of quality and convenience as you do with the jeans. So again, how you get started with them, distilled.com/capspace, and you can get $10 off your first order. distilled.com/capspace for $10 off right now. Houston, I guess the place to start with them is your Lone Wolf series continued from yesterday's program.
They're 8-5, 5-2 since the last time we did this, 4th in offense, 22nd in defense, but the disparity with and without Harden is almost awe-inspiring, to be genuine about it. They're plus 10.9 with him on the floor, and that's anchored by a 115 offensive rating, which is incredible. It's really good.
Yeah, that's like Nash Suns with him on the floor, Curry, Warriors with him on the floor type of levels.
And considering that he's really their only creator in a lot of those lineups because they just got Beverly back a couple days ago, they're doing that. And then when he's off the floor, they're getting outscored by 21.7 per 100 and have an offensive rating of 87.9.
Yeah, really no better. We ran through those stats last time around as well. Beverly, as you mentioned, is back, only played two games, but they have been excellent when he's played, mostly on the offensive end, but he has a 14.9 net rating. They had a nice win over the Jazz as well, even though the Jazz were a little bit shorthanded. And this team is really starting to roll. I mean, that type of differential with your main guys on the floor, that's pretty good. And hopefully now with Beverly back, they can play him a little bit more off the bench. Tyler Ennis and his negative 15.7 net rating are excised from the rotation. And really everyone else on this team, the next lowest ratings are, you know, negative 3.2 for KJ McDaniels, 1.7 for Nene. Sam Decker is very slightly negative. So if you want to just go by that, which of course is a little bit unfair to Ennis, but just he is, to put it charitably, is on the lower end of NBA players, never really done enough to show that he's a rotation player. So it's one of those things where just getting that one guy out of the rotation, maybe these guys really take off and go on a run. What's their schedule look like over the next couple of weeks?
It's kind of a mix. So they go at Detroit, that'll be on Monday night, then they host Toronto, and then they go on a Western Conference, let's call it, road trip at Sacramento, at Portland, at Utah, at the Warriors, at Denver.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting. That Warriors game will be a nice test for them too. That's going to be just a crazy offensive game the way both these teams are playing. The other thing though about this team, and you know, they're 5-2 in their last seven since we last checked in on them, I think the last we looked at it, they were like sixth in offense and like 29th in defense. And now they're fourth and 22nd. That's getting closer now to kind of where they need to be. You know, I'd like to even see them higher than that in offense, third, second. But especially if they continue to score that way with Harden on the floor and they can just not be a train wreck when he's off, that's very much attainable. And then if, you know, they can just get the defense to 20th, this is going to be a team to be reckoned with in the West, you know, talking about a team that can get into the sixth, fifth, even fourth seed potentially with Utah struggling a bit with these injuries.
Two things I wanted to bring up before we move on. One is that in that game against the Jazz on Saturday afternoon, they only played nine guys. They had a nine-guy rotation. Beverly started, so their four subs were Gordon, Nene, Decker, and Brewer. If they can tolerate that, if they don't need to go deeper in their bench, they're going to be a lot better in that. It's something you alluded to. And then something that will fundamentally change with that shift in the bench and just playing a lot of these shaky guys is that I was getting incredibly frustrated. We talked about this on the show a little bit, that they were playing at the same pace with or without Harden, because you can just muck it up with those. But once those bench players, like the overall talent gets better, you don't have to worry as much about that, because now they're, you know, they're a deep enough team at full strength that they'll have the talent advantage on some opponents. But that just wasn't true when they had to have Eric Gordon in the starting lineup and were playing the Ennis's and KJ's of the world.
Yeah. Now, of course, they look great now, but they're completely and totally healthy.
And dependent on one guy.
Yeah. If Harden, I mean, you know, he's been very healthy through his career, but if he just misses three or four games, I mean, they're sunk in those games. Gordon, Anderson, those guys, not the best health records. Nene, same thing. They really have like no one at backup center whatsoever. Wanted to talk a little bit about kind of what their offense looks like under Mike D'Antoni. I mean, Harden, of course, has the ball in his hands a ton, but they are second in percentage of plays in transition, right up there with Oklahoma City and Golden State. And then Eric Gordon and Trevor Ariza are both in the top seven of spot up possessions used. And then Clint Capella, number one in cuts. You know, again, we talked about that with Rudy Gobert dump offs. He's got 49 of those already, and he has been very efficient on those. 1.22 points per possession, shooting 72% on those shots. Although his free throw shooting has been awful and he turns it over every once in a while. But what all that shows, of course, is, hey, how are you getting spot ups? How are you getting dump offs? James Harden is creating that for you. And so it shows that they now finally, in Capella, Ariza, Gordon, Anderson, they have the players who can convert the opportunities that Harden is creating. And he's just doing all that now.
Capella's all the way up to 40% from the line now. Woohoo!
All right, let's move on. Who we got next here?
Next up, a team that we never talk about on the Dunked On Basketball podcast, the Golden State Warriors. 11-2, 7-0 since the last time we did this. First in offense with a 113.7 offensive rating and 20th in defense.
We talk about them so little that you made that exact same joke on the last 15 and 60. Was that intentional, or do you just like, or is that just like,
no,
totally
that was
unlucky?
Just me straight up forgetting that I've made that joke recently.
Well, I think clearly when you unintentionally make a joke twice in a row, you know what it means for every future episode.
No, I'm not going to make it again. Now I'm going to remember it because we pointed out on the show.
Well, you can't stop me from making it, though.
That's true. I don't want to stop you from making it.
Yeah, so they are first by a mile in offense, that 113.7. And like, honestly, I don't even feel like they're like playing in some unsustainable way. I think this is just who they are offensively.
I think they can do better. There were moments in a few of these road games. I think it was the third quarter against Toronto, the third or second quarter against the Bucks, where they were missing a lot of shots that they usually make. And no, it was the second quarter against the Bucks. And they're just a really, really good offensive team. And I've doing radio appearances in the Bay Area. I have done a little bit of talking hosts off the ledge in terms of their defense. But if they're scoring this much, it's not as big of an issue anyway. And I also don't think it's an issue in the playoffs.
So here's how they've been getting to that offense, which is a little bit different than a lot of people would think. You think, all right, Steph Curry, they do a ton of pick and roll, they play off of that. Not really the case at all. There are two categories in which they are number one in the league by a mile. The first of those is coming off of screens. They have 160 possessions coming off of screens, and they are averaging a ridiculous 1.24 points per possession. That's KD, that's Steph, that's Klay screening for each other, coming off of floppy sets, whatever. And also, what makes them so hard to guard is that you have to get guys out of that. You have to switch it, or they're going to score this ridiculous 1.24 points per possession on you. And I think, again, with the shooters they have, that's something that is kind of sustainable. The next lowest highest team in the league, the Dallas Mavericks, with 89. So the Warriors have almost double the number of off-screen possessions of any other team. The other thing that they do a ton more than anybody else is getting points off of cuts. And we talked on a few of the previous teams that cuts is normally going to be dump offs at the rim, and they've been getting their fair share of those, but also they get a ton of layups as well. Klay Thompson, for example, is the only guard in the top 50 on off cuts, and he's not just waiting under the rim for a dump off. He's making a cut. Steph, same thing as him. So the Warriors, 138 possessions on their cuts, 1.52 points per possession on those. The Jazz are second in the league with 106, and they're only averaging 1.04 points on that. They're not the second highest in terms of points per possession, but you can see that they are the Warriors are ridiculous on these cuts. Alternatively, they actually have the second lowest pick and roll ball handler frequency and the 10th lowest isolation frequency. So they're not doing that much. And then they also have the lowest spot up percentage. Those are usually plays that come off of just straight drives, pick and rolls, where you just throw it to a guy who's hanging out in the corner. That's not how they're getting a lot of their threes. They're getting them off of screens a lot, or in transition, which is another one in which they are third in transition percentage and first in points per possession in transition with all the threes that they take as well. So really a very rare categorization for the way their offense is working. I think they actually at times could stand to go to more pick and roll against the Bucks, for example. You saw when they went to the death lineup, part of why I think that lineup is usually so effective, not only because they have such great personnel, but they just go to that bread and butter Steph Draymond pick and roll with shooters around it, and you just have no way to stop it unless you're going to switch. What did you think about that Bucks game that I was at? You saw it. You had any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, it was an interesting game, just in terms of the sense of that they weren't able to prevent the Bucks from doing a lot of what they do well. Some of that was also attributable to, like, they played Kevon Looney, Milwaukee's his hometown. He struggled a lot against their front line. And they also bounced around the defensive assignments. So early on in the game, it was Draymond on Giannis and KD on Jabari. I thought Durant struggled a lot to guard Jabari Parker, which isn't super surprising considering Jabari is just, he's a force in a different kind of way than Durant really does.
KD, his defensive effort is quite variable from game to game.
Very inconsistent. Like, when he's on, he's been spectacular. He's had some really nice moments.
He was great in the Boston game. That second half of the Boston game, he was ridiculous.
Yeah, and then he had one, I'm trying to remember which game it was, at Oracle, where he was really in. I think maybe it was the Suns game, where he was like in the second quarter and they were great, and then he was bad in the third quarter and they were terrible. And so he can be that, but at the same point, I expect that to be fine in the playoffs. And it was also a good encapsulation of what I'm calling the Klay Thompson open shot roller coaster, which is that ever since, I think it was about the fourth game of the year, when people started freaking out about Klay's shot, it has been like rolling the dice every single time about whether Klay's going to make that wide open look or miss it. And usually he's pretty automatic in that. And when you think about how good this offense has been and that they've haven't had that stability, it should give little like shudders down the spine of everybody in the league, because Thompson is, that's one of the things he's best at in the league. And he's been shaky.
Yeah, although he's found it lately. I think over like his last six games or something, he's shooting 47%. He's averaging 23 a game. My other takeaways from that Bucks game, when the Bucks went with Teletovic and actually started switching everything, the Warriors did not score in the last 247 except for an intentional foul on Klay in the last 10 seconds of the game. And that's because the Bucks were really getting into the Warriors. Steve Kerr talked about them playing, his exact words were, a lack of force, not making hard cuts, just kind of hanging out, lobbing the ball in for ISOs. He was really upset by that. And the Bucks played some excellent defense there, but the Warriors had to go through some great pain to get better against switches. And the thought was, all right, teams are never going to switch against Kevin Durant. But my feeling is, especially when you look at like what some of their numbers are coming off of screens, off of cuts, like we talked about, your number one priority has to be to take that away. And the way you do that generally is by switching. You can still get those plays with some trickery, but it's much, much harder to do. And so I think, if you want to make Kevin Durant go one-on-one every possession, or make Steph Curry go one-on-one every possession, you can. And Steph Curry, we talked a little bit about him being back, but a closer look at the numbers to me is showing that that's not really the case compared to last year, because everything that, I haven't looked at exactly what he's shooting off the dribble, but if you look at how his points per possession have been, he has 64 possessions so far out of the pick and roll, only averaging 0.64 points per possession. That's really bad, obviously, when last year, you know, he was shooting all these threes off the dribble. He was over a point per possession last year. You couldn't switch on him. He has not really been successful in those ISOs on off of switches, just regular ISOs. He's been really bad this year too, compared to last year. So I think he has been very effective working off the ball, not as effective with the ball in his hands, you know, making the play himself. Maybe that'll come back, but he has not been this incredible player shooting threes off the dribble the way he had been in years past.
He also hasn't been as good defensively, and that can be more effort.
Yeah, or on the boards for that matter.
Right. And so I think that he's not all the way back in that sense, but he's been phenomenal.
I mean, and I'm not even going to say he's injured too. And also, like,
well, yeah, it's just off.
Games,
like, there are lots of ways that a guy can be off.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're not making excuses for him because he's injured like that. But, you know, so, but, and I had posited too that I thought with Durant coming in, with him being a year older, with maybe that injury affecting his offseason training, that maybe, you know, he was not going to have this magical season again. There's been times where it's looked like maybe he would, but there have been times where he looked like, you know, not so much so far this year.
A point that you brought up, and it was something that we harped on back in the Olympics with Durant, though he is far from the only offender here, is that the Warriors have been horrendous defending cuts this year.
Yeah, that's true. They are allowing 11.3% of opponents' possessions on cuts, and also giving up by far the worst points per possession, the same as they're allowing, the same as they're scoring themselves, 1.52. So that's really bad. The other thing, too, is they are allowing the lowest percentage of opponent post-up possessions. I mean, I don't know if that's even allowing, because post-ups aren't that efficient, but that's probably an artifact just of they are forcing other teams to play small, and those teams, that means that they don't have, you know, big post-up players.
No, it's just people being scared of posting up Zaza Pachulia. It's the whole thing.
Yeah. All right, let's move on here to the Denver Nuggets. 4-8, a somewhat disastrous 1-5 since we last checked in on them. They had been playing very well. They blew 2-3 games early. They were coming off a blowout of Boston when we last looked at them. And they've been hurt a little bit by the injury bug. Missing Wilson Chandler was a big problem for them. Will Barton finally came back today against the Jazz. Did they win that game, by the way?
They did. They won by 15.
They beat the Jazz by 15, huh? Yeah, Jazz,
Sorry, 14.
Not looking that good. That was in Denver, right?
It was.
Yeah.
And they played, Utah played the day before in Houston. So do you have all that going for it? But you posited the question of what's up with Jokic, and that got me going down a little bit of a research path. And there's some fascinating dynamics with this. So as an individual scorer, before tonight's game, Jokic was much more efficient with Nurkic on the floor. So those two big lineups, a lot of that can be just small sample size theater. 55.9% field goal percentage with him, 42.6 without him. But there are, it's a great sample because you have large, it's pretty similar in terms of minute distribution for Nurkic and Jokic together and either one of them separately. And I think it's in the like 130 range, is somewhere around there. And they've been different teams, but somewhat similar, just general paths with just Jokic and just Nurkic. It's hard to say those names in sequence. They've been a better offensive, worse defensive team with Jokic, +3, but 105 offense, which is quite good. And then with Nurkic, they've been stingy defensively, 99.7 defensive rating, +1.4. And with both of them, the biggest difference, the defense has been worse, but their offense craters. So they're over 100 with both those guys. They're at 93.4 when they play together.
Yeah, and 108.8 on defense, which makes sense, I think, in both respects. So yeah, maybe it's time. I mean, I understand why they wanted to start with this alignment, both for the pride of Nurkic in some respects, and Nurkic has played well coming back from that partially torn patellar tendon that really made last year a lost season. Jokic, of course, was really good last year, so you felt like you couldn't not start him. He was looking like someone who might be the best player on this team at some point relatively soon. But so you wanted to see whether you could make that work. The answer so far appears to be no. And I think that my favorite lineup still for this team that I'd like to see more of is Chandler, Gallo, and Nurk in the front court, but then you've got Fareed and Jokic, actually. Jokic, Gallo, and Chandler in the front court, and just really that's going to be an unstoppable offensive alignment, especially if you threw in like a Will Barton who can penetrate, Moutier who can get to the basket. You can run pick and pop all day with Jokic. If they switch it, Jokic can post that guy up. He's great at posting up switches. That's a lineup that I would like to see more of, but it does not seem like Mike Malone is really going to be going in that direction that much. And in his defense, it's hard. They have a lot of guys who can play on this team, a lot of young guys that they want to see some of. They've had guys in and out of the lineup. Very difficult to really establish a rotation, but it seems to me that Jokic, I still feel like, is more of the future than Nurkic, or especially Fareed. And if this season starts getting away from them any further, I don't think it's gotten there yet because they are 4-8. I think that their numbers are not that bad as a team. They've had some very, very nice stretches. I think they should still try to reach that. But if it does start getting away, I think you just minimize some of Fareed's minutes. You just play those two centers, don't play them together very much, and kind of go in that direction instead.
I would also like to see them, when they start separating those guys a little bit more, play each of them with a lot of the other starters. Just try it out, see how it works. You know, you can, whether that be a quick pull on somebody like Jokic or however you want to make it work, because there are some dynamics with Nurkic in particular defensively. If they end up going down the line, let's say end of this year in next year, with a Moutier Murray backcourt, you want a more stable defensive center and you want to figure that out. But they're, you know, you want to kind of have a sense of both things, because they do have like their best players might not necessarily fit together, but they're all good players and should be worthy of being on the next good Nuggets team. So I'm excited to see how it all works out. In today's game, Barton was back. Barton started, played all right. And we'll see how they do that in Gary Harris's absence, because now it's going to be a lot of minutes for Barton, a lot of minutes for Jamal Murray. And they have a chance to figure out what they have. And I talked when I had Adam Marius on Real Jam Radio, friend of both of ours, and part of what makes the Nuggets one of the most interesting teams in the league for the next 2 months is that they can be buyers, sellers, or both. And whatever they do with that, I would be a seller more on that line. But they have a lot of talent. They have a lot of talent that other teams are going to be interested in. How their front office manages these actually 3 months is going to be exciting.
I think that's right. And they may just kind of chill out a little bit.
I hope not. I hope they go bold. Like with Gallo especially. I mean, he's complicated, but the benefit that they have is they can have conversations with this guy. He's on their team. They've had him for years. And if he's open to coming back at a reasonable rate, you can do something like that. And if not, I've fake traded him to every single good team in the Eastern Conference for the last year and a half.
Talk a little bit more about Jokic too. He's just not hitting his shots. That's one of the big problems here. He's shooting 20% on threes and 33% on long twos. That's going to change. He's too good of a shooter for that. He's got a great record at pretty much all levels. I mean, he may have been a little over his head last year, but he's just a fabulous offensive center. I mean, if you guard him with a conventional center, he can pick and pop for either twos or threes, make a play. He's a phenomenal passer. Or if you want to switch it, then he can get down in the post and make plays out of the post. So I think he's just, and it's not like, you know, Nurkic is a little bit better defensively, but he's not like so good. And same thing with Fareed. So I think it's still, Jokic would be the guy that I would be focusing on as the future, starting him, putting him in a position to succeed. And, you know, maybe your defense isn't going to be that great because while he knows the angles pretty well for a young guy, he's very limited athletically in that respect. But I think I want to see what this offense could be with him playing at center full time with shooting around him. And that I think also would really help Moutier's efficiency to have more of a space floor. When you consider how much time they've been spending with two traditional bigs, Moutier can get to the rim. You know, he's sort of like latter day Derrick Rose in that respect. He can get to the rim, he can create shots, but although he's gotten a little better at finishing, still not quite there yet. If he has some more space, much like Kemba Walker's game has been unlocked in some ways by playing with more space, I think he could really benefit from that same thing. One more stat here before we move on. Actually, two more. I'll leave one of them to you. Nurkic has 52 post-ups, 0.69 points per possession. Jokic, only 19 post-ups, 0.95. Again, Jokic, not really a good option to post up against centers who are his size. But then again, neither is Nurkic, because he's not very efficient either. I mean, that's why Jokic doesn't have a higher number there. But I would like to see them try to run more plays where they can get a switch with Jokic and get him down on the block, because he is one of the league's best at attacking mismatches.
Denver also has, depending on how they're going to use their backcourt rotation, I mean, both Murray and Moutier can effectively run pick and rolls, especially if you have the floor space. So that should create more switches than they've gotten before. And we referenced this in the first part of this 15 and 60, but Denver has been rough in crunch time. I mean, it is only 35 minutes. And again, that is with 5 points or closer, with 5 minutes or fewer remaining in the game. They're 2-6 with a negative 21.9 net rating. And that includes a couple of just absolute collapses against the Blazers and just some other strange bad performances.
Yeah, the Denver game.
Yeah.
Minnesota? Not the Denver game. The Memphis game.
Yeah, that's the one I was saying. Okay. And so that will maybe be part of their undoing. It's also a part of the process of figuring out who's good and who's not good on this team. You know, they're in that at the same time. But it's not the worst thing in the world as long as they have the right perspective on it. And it's more ownership than anyone else, because they have to understand that this is a team that's going to go through growing pains.
All right. It is about time for the Dallas Mavericks. But first, it is time to talk to you about watches. Time to talk to you about watches. See, you have that. We've been on fire today, by the way. But much more on fire than my horrendous jokes is Movement Watches, spelled MVMT. MVMTwatches.com/capspace is our custom URL there, at which you can get 15% off your order with free shipping and free returns today. It is a beautiful, clean design on these watches. Excellent quality. They sold over 500,000 of these in 160 countries. They look like, feel like the type of watch that you're going to pay $400 to $500 for at a department store, but they start at just $95. The one that I have is the Gunmetal Sandstone. That's $135. And they were kind enough to send one to my girlfriend, which she loves. And then my mom likes it so much that she bought one, and she bought one for both of my cousins, her nieces as well. So both men's and women's will make a great Christmas present, either for our very, very few female listeners, for your significant other as a guy. If you want to get a watch for your female significant other, it's fantastic. Or your dad, brother, whatever. These are great watches, and they're actually like a reasonably priced for a Christmas present, not like some $500 watch. So again, the way to get started with them, Movement Watches, MVMTwatches.com/capspace. Get that 15% off today. Dallas Mavericks, 2-10. They again have gone 1-5 since the last time we did this. Are they done?
Yep. I mean, realistically, even if they were at full strength, which they're not going to be for a while now, they are not good enough to even be 8 games over 500. Like that's possible, but too rosy to predict. And they're gonna get deeper below 500, in my opinion, between now and then.
Yeah, and you noted, I didn't realize this, they are 30th in offense right now. I mean, they've been scoring like 77 points against the Knicks, who are a pretty bad defense. You know, they actually have been pretty decent defensively, which I guess you could expect. Their personnel isn't that bad without Dirk in there. They've still got Bogut. Barnes is okay. They got guys like Justin Anderson, and they've been playing Finney Smith, who can defend a little bit, but is looking like a pretty big non-threat offensively so far. And Barnes, he started off really well, though now he's 2-for-14 on jumpers in his last couple of games, so maybe that's the beginning of his regression on some of these mid-rangers. He is third in the league in ISO possessions, basically their only way to create offense with Dirk out. 1.14 points per possession, that's not going to sustain. He can't keep that up. You know, even if he's at one, that's about the best that anybody is an ISO. And while I appreciate the work that he's put in to get there, you also have to notice that he's not passing at all either out of those plays. So it might be time to start like maybe committing some more defenders if you have him in a mismatch. They do a good job of like getting the switch on the pick and roll, giving him a matchup that he can attack. So I think that helps him. And he's also at 1.03 points per possession on his 29 post-ups. Again, we talked yesterday about kind of the blurred line between post-ups and ISOs in these stats, but it's just showing that he has been able to create his offense one-on-one. They are really have nothing else going on other than him. That's why they're 30th.
They also, if you want to talk about like why this team is frustrating to watch, and it goes in a couple of different directions. I think this was, I compiled this before their rough loss in Orlando, but they're the lowest team. They have the fewest transition frequency. So they're, that was 7% of their possessions as of Saturday morning.
And that makes sense. Like this is the toolbox that Rick Carlisle went to down the end of last year when he realized that they were really struggling and didn't have the talent, and they were able to get some wins that way, but even he can't magic it up at this point.
Yeah, and they have the league worst offensive points per possession in transition, and then they are also leading the league in terms of isolation frequency as a team, and of course you mentioned Harrison Barnes, and opponent isolations. So it's just a lot of basketball I do not enjoy watching.
Yeah, no, it has not been good. I mean, every once in a while they'll have some nice little smart plays by Bogut, but they don't really work out. So I agree with you. I think they're done. Tim McMahon wrote the kind of pre-mortem, I guess we could call it, saying, hey, you know, let's just hope that Barnes ends up being pretty good this year. They're not going to get back in it, and they should really trade away some of their veterans, starting with Bogut. So I think the two guys who are still decent players who are on expiring contracts on this team, Bogut and Deron Williams. Who needs these guys?
A lot of teams need point guards. So if Deron Williams can get back from this his calf injury and really show something, they're, you know, whether it be starter or backup, if he wants to move, and that's an important part of this when you're dealing with veterans, especially somebody like Deron, who it seems like took a
discount. And he actually can veto a trade as well.
Yeah, because of the bird rights issue, which is
because he was on a 1 year deal last year, signed another successive 1 year deal. If he were to be traded, he would lose his early bird rights, and so then he can in fact veto trade. Maybe he would want to take one if they start going younger, if he wants to go somewhere where he can be on a contender, but he is from Dallas. In theory, maybe he took less to stay. He might have also taken less to stay because everyone on other teams didn't want him because he's kind of annoying to be around by all reports. But if they did want to trade him, I think that there are quite a few teams that could use it. Really half the league could use a guy who could swing between the one and the two, who can shoot, who can dribble, who can pass like he can. There are a lot of teams with big deficits in the backcourt like that.
I'd love to see him on Charlotte. That's one of my personal favorites because Sessions is fine, but just getting somebody who can kind of play with and away from Kemba would be great for them. Like Jeremy Lin.
I mean, think of, there's a billion teams that could use a better backup point guard. Memphis, Houston would be desperate for anybody who can do anything off the dribble other than Harden on this team. New Orleans, Sacramento, Oklahoma City could desperately use him. Milwaukee, San Antonio could really use him. The Wizards could use a backup point guard. Detroit, Orlando, Atlanta. Like there are the Bulls, even the Cavs could use him. Now, you could just see him potentially if he doesn't get traded or he vetoes a trade. I think if I were him, what I'd do is just try to work a buyout, maybe even earlier in the season if it looks like things are really going south for this Dallas team, and they should be totally on board with that. I mean, the only reason not to buy him out is so that you could then re-sign him again next year with full bird rights. And so you work a buyout. There are a bunch of teams that even have like their, you know, part of their mid-level left or the room mid-level. You can go there for most of the year and you have that leverage to get the buyout because you say, hey, I'm just going to veto a trade. You're not going to get anything for me anyway.
And you might as well. That could claim him off waivers. So,
yeah, well, yeah, with $9 million. I mean, the Jazz, I think, would be, and Philly would be like the only teams that would be.
Would he fit in the Cavs trade exception? I think he would.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't. Yeah. They wouldn't do that. That would be such a weird.
That would be a lot of money for Dan. And I don't think he like puts them over the edge either.
No.
As far as like playing against, I mean, they've done just in the playoffs. I mean, really, their backup point guard issue is just a regular season issue because they'll just go with LeBron as the backup point guard in the playoffs.
Yeah, especially if Shump can give him a couple minutes, they'll be fine.
Yeah, Shump's been playing really well. But I think, you know, now that I talked through this, I think that's probably what's going to happen. I mean, if you're going to trade, and again, if you're going to trade for D-Will, nobody's going to give up a first rounder for him. Most of these teams are good, so their second rounders don't do much for you. There's not a ton there, I think, as far as trading him. What about Bogut?
There are lots of teams that need a backup center too. The funniest,
are there? I actually kind of struggled to find him a little bit.
I think he'd be really good. But see, it's funny with the way the Hawks have used Muscala. So they functionally used him as kind of the go-between at both spots with Mike Scott being out. And he can do that, but Bogut and Millsap would just be fun. I think that would work really well, depending on how they want to do it. I mean, it's weird. Like, I mean, I've joked about the Warriors before. The issue there is that they could get him via trade. They cannot get him if he gets bought out, because that's the, I call it the Zdrunas Ilgauskas rule. I'm not really sure if that's who, I think that's who was targeted after in the first place.
Well, I think, I mean, there are a bunch of those. Like Jerry Stackhouse was once like traded away from the Mavs, I think, and then they re-signed him as well. But yeah, Ilgauskas, I think he was traded away from Cleveland and then was bought out and then it went back to Cleveland. I think he was probably the last guy that was allowed to do that under the old CBA, and then they changed that rule, which makes sense. I mean, trading a guy away just to fill salary and then waiting 30 days to bring him back, like that's all kind of ridiculous. Like, it makes a little
I have a couple more teams for him, especially. I did a podcast that they asked me about this. Boston, I think he'd be a wonderful fit there. Toronto, if they
wait, hold on, Boston, I don't know, like he's not better than any of their centers at full strength.
You don't think he's better than Zeller?
Zeller is the fifth big.
Yeah, but he's better
than Zeller. You don't want to, if you're Boston, you're not going to give up any kind of an asset.
No, you're not going to give up an asset for him. But if you give, let's say you trade them Zeller for Bogut, you would do that, right?
I mean, I think Dallas could probably do better than that, even though Zeller, and I think they actually like Zeller on that non-guaranteed contract for next year as a trade asset.
Yeah.
At $8 million a year. This is my list of teams that I had. Maybe we can go through. So Golden State, they're not going to have the matching salary. That's the biggest problem. I mean, they would have to move on. Like, he's making $12 million, so they'd have to basically get up to $8 million in salary to acquire him. And there's really just about no way that they could. I mean, they would have to trade like McAdoo and Varejao and Clark and JaVale McGee.
If they had done the human trade exception, like you had advocated for, they would have had the space.
Yeah, and Zaza, they can't really trade because, you know, they enticed him to sign there for less. I mean, maybe it would be like, it would be really difficult. And I think also like the bridges have kind of been burned there too. They're pretty sick of him. Although I think even this year more than ever, because they have David West, who's actually been playing awesome, it might help. So, but that's, I think that's kind of a pipe dream. I would love him as a starting center in Portland. I think that would be excellent. And maybe they could just send back Azili in a trade. That would be close enough to matching salary. Maybe like, you know, or like a Jake Lehman or I don't know if that would be enough, but yeah. Or in like a second rounder or something like that, you know, maybe that would do it. New Orleans could really use him, but they also, and the Knicks could too, but both of those teams already have a ton of guys.
The Lakers could up. Too.
Yeah, but yeah, again, like all of those guys have like starting centers making over $10 million, maybe don't want to give up an asset, would might struggle to cobble together the salary. The Bucks too already have, and he's, I think he also may have burned a few bridges on his way out of town there as well. Houston, where he was rumored, it was the other place that he is deciding between Houston and Dallas. The Warriors reportedly sent him to Dallas because that's where he'd prefer to go. But Houston, especially with Nene, maybe could use him. But he, you know, he's probably the third best center on that team. And then Atlanta is the other one. So not other than Portland, nowhere that I feel is like some great fit there. I mean, maybe he gets bought out and then he signed somewhere for the stretch run as like, you know, a backup center. But at just his level of salary, and I don't know how the Hawks cobble together the salary for him either. Maybe like something with like Humphreys and a few other guys. But Portland is the only one that I really look at as like he, I think, and their defense has been so bad, as we noted yesterday. I think he actually could really help Portland.
I think he could help Indiana too, but they just spent all that money on Al Jefferson, so it's unlikely to happen.
Yeah, that's another one where, and then like what's the matching salary? You know, Indiana has like quite a few bad contracts
Rodney
now.
Rodney Stuckey kind of fits something that Mark Cuban likes. Outside possibility.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Which of the bad contracts that Indiana has are they going to offer back that Mark Cuban's not going to want? Yeah, I mean, now if he is taking, maybe Stuckey offers something that they like. Because I mean, yeah, if I'm Dallas and now I'm going to start racing for the bottom here. Yeah, goodbye Bogut, goodbye D-Will as soon as possible, I think.
I would agree with that. And yeah, and they are in this place where they, if Dirk, it really, you know, they've kind of played the waiting game with him for a few years and, you know, what he's going to do. And they definitely gave this team a shot. Like they bought short term with guys like Bogut. But if they're out of it, then I think I'm pretty confident Dirk will understand.
Yeah, I mean, who knows when Dirk even is going to be back yet. He's still and Rick Carlisle said, hey, you know, if this were the playoffs, I might try and force him back. We have so many guys out anyway, essentially, like we're not going to win even if he does come back. And I think that's probably accurate at this point.
Do you want to get even sadder and have me tell you about their upcoming schedule?
Well, I mean, we've established that tanking and getting a high draft pick is the best thing they can do. So maybe it's time to flip our ideas and be happy at what I'm sure you're going to say is like a really difficult upcoming schedule.
At San Antonio, hosting the Clippers. At Cleveland, hosting the Pelicans, hosting the Spurs.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's no way they win more than one of those games. So that's going to put them at 3-14. And now you're not, if you weren't done before, now you're really done.
Congratulations, Mark Helfaltz.
Yeah, who knows what'll happen
really
with Dirk?
Nice like, for him.
Oh yeah, I mean, like you play your first couple of years like running some pick and rolls with Dirk. Yeah, where do I sign up for that as like a ball dominant card? Actually, we were talking about this on our Dork G Chat thread of like who the NBA comparison for Marco Fultz is. Did you want to weigh in on that?
I need to watch more of him, but I like him a lot. I'll tell you that right now. He's different. Like I see some Westbrook in him just in terms of the way he uses his body, but I think he's a better shooter and a better passer than Russ was at that age, but Russ improved so much as he got older.
I got one. Dwayne Wade.
Yeah, I'm good with that. Totally good with that.
So, like, more shooting guard size, but good pick and roll guard, excellent feel in the pick and roll, solid passer, like better passer than your normal shooting guard, sneaky athleticism getting to the rim. I don't think he quite has Wade's length, and he definitely doesn't have Wade's defensive instincts, but on offense, like I think, and again, we'll have to see how he finishes the year. He's been on fire these first couple of games, and we won't get into him too much until draft time rolls around, but I mean, that's like the comparison, I think, so far.
Yeah, I see a little Moutier in him, too, just with the idea of...
Yeah, but he's way more athletic than Moutier. Yeah. That's what I like about that.
I like Fultz a lot. Big fan.
All right, we done here?
Yeah.
All right. Don't forget about our sponsors today, Movement Watches, MVMTwatches.com/capspace gets you that 15% off. And also, our friends at Distilled. Distilled.com, DSTLD.com/capspace. Gets you $10 off of your first order. No Twitter NBA show this week because of Thanksgiving. We'll be back for that next week. We'll have one more show this week, and I also may actually rerun one since we have a bunch of new listeners that is kind of more of an evergreen episode just to give you guys something to listen to over Thanksgiving if you're traveling. But we'll be back tomorrow. Talk to y'all then.